Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 15, 2018, during a live Courthouse Steps Teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon, our conversation is on yesterday's Supreme Court decision on McCoy versus Louisiana. My name is Michael Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Jay Schweikart, a policy analyst for the Project on Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute. After hearing from our speaker, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us, Jay. The floor is yours.
Thanks very much. So I'm just going to start by giving a little bit of an overview of kind of the fact background in this case and the legal framework, and then get into what the court's decision was. So as Micah mentioned, this is a case that was decided yesterday, McCoy v. Louisiana. This was an appeal from a decision of the Louisiana Supreme Court, which upheld a death sentence for the defendant here, Robert McCoy, who had been convicted of three murders. And the basic legal question that the court was deciding is whether it's unconstitutional for defense counsel to admit a defendant's guilt to the jury over the defendant's express objection. So to give a little background here, so Robert McCoy was arrested for the murder of murder of three victims who were the mother, stepfather, and son of his estranged wife. He maintained his innocence throughout every stage of the pretrial proceedings, insisting that he was actually out of the state at the time of the killings. He had an alibi defense that maybe was not that strong, but that he genuinely believed that that he was innocent of the crimes. He so consistently maintained his innocence, believed actually that the victims had been killed by corrupt police officers who were conspiring against him, filed several pro se requests for subpoenas for witnesses who would have had knowledge of his alibi defense. He was initially assigned two public defenders, but dismissed them because they had different theories of this case. And then at one point he requested that he be allowed to represent himself. The court found him mentally competent to do so. But then his family engaged another attorney, Larry English, to represent him. English, like the previous public defenders, was skeptical of this alibi defense that McCoy was asserting and refused to issue subpoenas to go along with it. So there was a little bit of tension between McCoy and his attorney from the beginning. But then, and this is really the key difference here, 16 days before trial, Mr. English told McCoy for the first time that he was planning to tell the jury that McCoy was guilty of murder, that he had killed the victims. The idea is that this was a capital case. The state was seeking the death penalty. And Mr. English thought that the evidence against McCoy was just so overwhelming that they had no hope of him being acquitted. The best they could do was to sort of curry favor with the jury by admitting guilt and taking responsibility with the hope of avoiding the death penalty at the sentencing stage, which is sometimes a reasonable tactic in death penalty cases. That's not a crazy thing to do. But McCoy adamantly opposed this and told English, absolutely not, I am innocent, do not tell the jury that I'm guilty. And then at a pretrial conference a few days later, which was the first time that McCoy had a chance to raise this issue with the judge, he said exactly that. He said, look, this guy's going to sell me out and tell them that I'm guilty. He's not my lawyer anymore. I don't want him to do this. You know, I want a new lawyer, or if not that, then I want to represent myself. And the court denied those requests, said that, no, Mr. English is your lawyer, we're going forward, and essentially instructed Mr. English to follow the strategy that he thought was best. And so then at trial, Mr. English told the jury in opening argument, he did it. I'm telling you that he is responsible for these murders. You should find him, he's guilty of second degree murder. But went forward with the strategy of trying to admit responsibility but mitigate the severity to avoid the death penalty. Mr. McCoy interrupted his own lawyer, arguing with him basically in front of the jury, took the stand in his own defense to present his alibi testimony, was then cross-examined by his own attorney. So there was a conflict between the defendant and his own attorney at trial in front of the jury. Unsurprisingly, the jury returned a guilty verdict, found him guilty of all three murders, and sentenced him to death. So the strategy failed. And so the question that went up before the Louisiana Supreme Court and then ultimately to the U.S. Supreme Court was whether this was constitutional, specifically whether it was constitutional for McCoy's attorney to admit his guilt over McCoy's objection. Just to give a little bit of the, you know, kind of background legal framework to understand the issue here, a couple principles. One, defendants absolutely have the right to represent themselves if they choose to do so. Once defendants decide to be represented by counsel, the attorney has the authority to make most tactical trial decisions. These are things like which witnesses to call, what questions to ask, you know, what to say in arguments, whether to, you know, what evidence to introduce or whether to object to evidence. These are all kind of within the province of the attorney's discretion. There are still there are certain fundamental decisions that the court has said defendants ultimately have final say on, even when they're represented by counsel. And the ones that they've given, the court has given as examples, is whether to enter a guilty plea, whether to waive the right to a jury trial, whether to testify at trial and what to say, and whether to take an appeal. And so in some sense, the question here is whether admitting guilt before a jury falls within, is sort of merely a tactical strategic question for the attorney, or whether it's one of these fundamental decisions that the defendant has the sole prerogative over. And then finally, is in terms of just the legal background, there's a 2004 case called Florida v. Nixon, which was sort of superficially similar in some respects. It was a murder trial. The defendant's attorney thought that there was overwhelming evidence and the best chance to avoid the death penalty was to admit guilt. He consulted with his client on this, saying that he thought they should do this. But there, in Nixon, unlike in this case, the defendant was unresponsive. He didn't consent or object to it. He basically just wasn't any help to his attorney. And so without guidance from his client, his attorney went forward at trial and presented this strategy and admitted, you know, responsibility for the murders to try to avoid the death penalty. And then afterwards, Nixon objected to this admission. And there, what the Supreme Court said in that case is, you don't have to get express consent to admit guilt. They specifically reserved, they did not answer the question of whether you can overrule a defendant's clear objection. So that was the question in this case, where the defendant expressly objects in advance to this admission, does the attorney have to follow with that? So McCoy's basic position here was this is about defendant autonomy. This is something, you know, he has a right to a personal defense, that the Sixth Amendment, you know, guarantees his right to make fundamental decisions. Whereas the state, you know, wanted to characterize this as basically, this is just a strategic trial question, and so his conviction should be upheld. And the court, in a decision yesterday, ruled 6-3 in favor of McCoy. They agreed that this was unconstitutional, and that they vacated the convictions and ordered a new trial for Mr. McCoy. The majority opinion was written by Justice Ginsburg, and it basically adopts exactly the framework that Mr. McCoy and the Cato Institute and our amicus brief were urging on appeal. Basically, that this is not a question about effective assistance of counsel. This has nothing to do with how reasonably his attorney performed. This is a question of defendant autonomy. And so the court, you know, acknowledged that division I mentioned about tactical questions and fundamental decisions, and then they said, and I'm quoting here from the opinion, autonomy to decide that the objective of the defense is to assert innocence belongs in this latter category, that category meaning the fundamental decisions reserved for the client. And Justice Ginsburg went on to say, these are not strategic choices about how best to achieve a client's objectives. They are choices about what the client's objectives in fact are. This was a theme that came up a lot at oral argument that the court really emphasized in its opinion, which is, different clients will have different objectives in a criminal case. Mr. English's sort of overriding goal here was to do anything possible to defeat the death penalty. That's sort of the attitude he was taking. What can I do to avoid a death sentence? Well, the best strategy is to admit guilt. But that's a value judgment. It is the way the court is characterizing this, and that Mr. McCoy argued on appeal. That may not be his most important goal. Some defendants may care more about, defending their innocence and sort of avoiding the. Here, I'm quoting again from the opinion, from Justice Ginsburg's opinion. Quote: Counsel may reasonably assess a confession of guilt as best suited to avoiding the death penalty, as English did in this case. But the client may not share that objective. He may wish to avoid, above all else, the opprobrium that comes with admitting he killed family members, or he may hold life in prison not worth living and prefer to risk death for any hope, however small, of exoneration. So this is a decision that is very protective of defendant autonomy and the defendant's right to decide what the objectives of their criminal defense are. The lawyer can consult with them, obviously, and can advise them of what they think is the best strategy, but ultimately the fundamental question about whether to admit guilt or not belongs with the defendant. And the court distinguished Florida v. Nixon on the obvious ground that, you know, there the defendant didn't make a choice either way, and so the attorney had to go forward with something, and that was a reasonable decision, whereas here there was a clear overruling of the client's objectives, which is what made the difference. And then another part of what the court said is that that Mr. McCoy automatically gets a new trial because this is so-called structural error. So one major question in terms of a lot of constitutional cases and criminal cases is, if there's a constitutional violation, under what circumstances is that significant enough to get a new trial? For certain kinds of errors, like, say, whether the state sufficiently turned over evidence they required to give, there's an error analysis where if the state can show that it wouldn't have made a difference either way, there's not necessarily – then the defendant doesn't get a new trial. But here – and the court identified this as structural error, and that's the kind of error where if there's a violation, you get a new trial, period, the end. There's no error analysis whatsoever. Because the question is not whether, you know, this increased the chances of an erroneous conviction, but it's basically saying Mr. McCoy had an autonomy right. And here I'll quote from the opinion. Here, however, the violation of McCoy's protected autonomy right was complete when the court allowed counsel to usurp control of an issue within McCoy's sole prerogative. So they're identifying these kind of Sixth Amendment secured autonomy rights as inherently structural error rights that warrant automatic reversal. So there was a dissent. So this is a 6-3 decision. There was a dissent by Justice Alito, which was joined by Justices Thomas and Gorsuch. It's actually a relatively narrow dissent. It's not so much disagreeing with the majority's fundamental analysis of this autonomy question, and more saying that this case wasn't a great vehicle for making this kind of grand pronouncement. Justice Alito spends a lot of time talking about how rare this kind of case is, that, you know, those usually will only come up in capital cases because that's really the only context where it might make strategic sense to admit guilt, and that usually defendants and their attorneys will be able to work this out in advance. And so there's a little bit of a, why are you making such a big deal out of this? Maybe we shouldn't have even taken this case to the dissent. Doctrinally, the distinction that the dissent is drawing here is it's basically saying that Mr. English's concession here wasn't a concession to which was the charged offense. Justice Alito is characterizing McCoy's attorney as saying, well, the actus reus, the actual act of killing these people was met, but Mr. McCoy didn't have the mental state, the intent necessary to commit first-degree murder, so he's not guilty of that offense. And so to Justice Alito, this was an important difference because he didn't understand, or he didn't think that Mr. English was admitting guilt entirely. Rather, he characterized him as just admitting an element of the crime. And therefore, the court shouldn't have made this grand pronouncement about admitting guilt when that's not really what happened in this case. Now, the majority does have a response to that, which is that even if Mr. English wasn't admitting guilt to first-degree murder, he clearly was admitting guilt to second-degree murder, which was a lesser-included offense in this murder charge. So, you know, Mr. English was not saying, my client didn't have the mental state, so you have to acquit. He was still saying that he should be convicted and spend the rest of his life in prison. He just thought he should be convicted of second-degree murder as opposed to first-degree murder. So that line is the major distinction between the majority and the dissent's opinion here. And then the dissent also criticized the majority for deciding the structural error question. Justice Alito would have not decided that here and would have left that to the Louisiana Supreme Court to decide in the first instance, whereas the majority thought that it was acceptable to sort of just decide that question along with the, you know, decide all of that right now. So yeah, that's the basic overview of what the opinion was and kind of what the different positions were. And I would love to answer any questions you have about the case.
Thank you, Jay. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request a floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first question.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Russell Kershey from Punta Gorda, Florida. My question is this. After being a prosecutor for 4 years and a defense attorney now for 20 years, it seems as though to me the dissent, which I read this morning, was really kind of a distinction without a difference, admitting that the person committed murder but not admitting that they committed first-degree murder, certainly in Florida, is virtually the same thing punishment-wise. I wonder if you could comment on whether you think that that's a distinct difference or whether it's really one, a distinction without the difference. Thank you.
Thanks. I tend to agree. I'll give a little more background here. I mean, the Cato Institute filed an amicus brief in this case in support of Mr. McCoy, and urging the court to think about this in terms of defendant autonomy. And I was very encouraged that the court pretty much adopted our framework entirely. So I definitely think the majority have the right approach here. I think when you're admitting guilt, when it comes to admitting guilt to a lesser included offense, right, that is one of the charged crimes. I mean, the whole point of a lesser included offense is that it is included within the offense. So when you were charged with first degree murder, that necessarily includes lesser offenses like second-degree murder. So to me, the real distinction is, are you admitting guilt or not? Are you abandoning the presumption of innocence or not? Because in this case, Mr. English sort of specifically said to the jury, I am taking the burden of proof off of you. I relieved you of this burden. I relieved the state of the burden. And that really is the major line. So I agree that sort of the distinction that Justice Alito is drawing between whether you're admitting guilt to first or second degree murder is a distinction without a difference for the purposes of this Sixth Amendment question. I mean, it matters in terms of whether you can get the death penalty or not, of course. But the question here in terms of defendant autonomy is you, the defendant, get to decide whether you are going to admit guilt or not. And I think I think there is a harder question, and this is something else that Justice Alito focuses on in his dissent, is whether it would be constitutional to admit one or more elements of the offense, but still challenge, but still argue for an acquittal. So, for instance, if the position here had been, Mr. McCoy committed a certain act, but he didn't have the requisite mental state to be convicted at all, so you must acquit. That, I think, is a harder question. I don't think that the attorney should be able to admit an element of the crime, any element of the crime, over the defendant's clear objection, but I think that's closer. And the majority didn't really, kind of left that question open, because this is a simpler case where there's, an admission of guilt entirely. So, I mean, it's a roundabout way of saying yes. I don't think that distinction is relevant for the question that was on appeal in terms of the Sixth Amendment autonomy question. But I do still think going forward, there is an unanswered question that Justice Alito rightly points out is more complicated about whether an attorney can admit any element of a crime over the defendant's objection. So we'll see if that comes up in future cases.
Thank you.
And while we're waiting for other questions, Jay, what did you make of the lineup of the particular justices based on, we know you also attended the oral argument for us. Did the lineup surprise you in any ways, or did how the case turn out surprise you, or was this foreseeable?
So I think after the argument, I felt pretty encouraged about the overall outcome. It seemed like most of the justices were fairly sympathetic to Mr. McCoy's case here. It was unclear to me how it was going to be written. And so the particular framework in Justice Ginsburg's opinion, I was very happy with, because it's just really completely nailed the whole defendant autonomy aspect of the case. So I was pretty optimistic about the result, but I wasn't sure how they were going to write it. On the lineup, I was a little disappointed and surprised to see Justice Gorsuch in the dissent, because at oral arguments, he seemed to express a lot of agreement with this idea of this is a values difference, right? Mr. McCoy had a different goal than his attorney did. And he also he pressed the state a lot on whether this should be structural error. So, you know, he seemed to be thinking that this violation, alleged violation is one that sort of should warrant automatic reversal. So I was expecting him actually to come down in favor of Mr. McCoy. I can imagine how maybe, you know, I guess ultimately he was persuaded by this idea that there's a distinction between the lesser included offense and the named charged offense. Aside from that, there weren't too many surprises. After oral argument, it seemed like Justice Alito was maybe the most skeptical of McCoy's position, so it's not surprising at all to me that he ended up writing the dissent here. Justice Thomas, as usual, didn't ask any questions at argument, so it's a little bit harder to predict. So overall, it makes sense. Justice Gorsuch's placement was just the one little bit of surprise, and, you know, I will admit is a little bit of a disappointment, because I think as we've seen so far, in a lot of ways, I think Justice Gorsuch has shown himself very protective of criminal defendants' rights. As a lot of people remarked on, he joined the so-called liberals in the Sessions v. DiMaia decision, striking down an aspect of the Immigration and Nationality Act as unconstitutionally vague. It's sort of a very defendant-friendly position. So. I was hoping he would be joining the majority here, but, you know, aside from that, very happy with the decision and very happy, you know, that it got at least 6 votes. So.
All righty. Let's go to our next question.
This is Warren Belmar calling from Florida. I have a question as to whether there are any implications for civil litigation arising from this decision.
Thank you. I think probably not, at least not directly, because what was doing the work here is the Sixth Amendment, right? The constitutional violation here was a violation of the Sixth Amendment, which concerns criminal defendants' trial rights. Certainly at a larger level, you know, it concerns the general ethical rules that, you know, govern attorneys, govern professional practice. The Supreme Court did note the majority opinion cited, let me pull this up here, ABA Model Rule of Professional Conduct 1.2a, which says that, quote, a lawyer shall abide by a client's decisions concerning the objectives of the representation. So obviously the idea about the sort of principle about, attorneys having to, you know, consult with their client and offer them advice and, you know, their counsel on strategic tactical questions, but, you know, ultimately having to take, you know, the client's values as their final say, is expands beyond the criminal context. I will say on a personal note, I mean, I'm an attorney. I used to work at a law firm, and, you know, most cases involve, you know, a lot. It's very common. It's very usual. It's not limited to criminal defense cases. It's very common where, you know, your client's perspective or, you know, what they want makes your job harder, and that can be frustrating. But, you know, too bad. Ultimately, you know, your job as a professional is to consult with your client and then, you know, listen to what they want. And when they've made an informed decision, that's the decision. I think this decision certainly reflects that general understanding of the attorney-client relationship. But in terms of the doctrine, right, I mean, the right that it's establishing is a Sixth Amendment right. So that's going to be limited for constitutional purposes. It's going to be limited to criminal defense cases.
Thank you.
And we have another question lined up here, so let's go ahead and move forward.
Hi, this is Kent Scheidegger. I have a question about looking forward as a practical matter.
Mm-hmm.
How would the state defend itself against a false claim in a case where, unlike this case, the defendant has not made any statement in court? But years later, he says, I made this objection to my lawyer, and my lawyer overrode me, and the lawyer falls on his sword and says, yes, that's right, and it's all made up. I agree in principle with the basic holding of the decision, but I just see a lot of potential for fraud here.
So, all right. So thank you. So, I think that what was key to the court's analysis here is that the defendant clearly objected in advance, like on the record. And this was, Mr. English testified to this to the court even before the trial started. Mr. McCoy made this objection directly to the judge on the record at this pretrial conference. And that distinction matters, right? That's what distinguishes this case from Nixon, where the outcome was different, is that Mr. McCoy consistently objected in advance at every stage. In terms of the idea of, defendants sort of conspiring with their attorneys to, fraudulently create a problem, I understand the concern in principle. I really don't think that that's going to be an issue. That risk exists in any case, right? Of course, we have an ineffective assistance jurisprudence. There are lots of things that defense attorneys could do to sort of throw the case, right? And yet we almost never see that happen because, of course, defense attorneys are worried, concerned about their professional, responsibilities, and they don't want to be sanctioned and they want to protect their reputation. So I think it would be the extraordinarily rare attorney who would be willing to go along with this kind of scheme, because what would be the point for them? And we don't see that generally, so I'm not sure why we would see it in this particular context.
It's not unusual in capital cases for the trial defense attorney to fall on its sword and admit ineffective assistance.
Sure. I guess what I mean is I don't think we see instances of fraud, of sort of basically the attorney intentionally committing misconduct, intentionally acting in a way that, doing something dumb that'll be, that can be called ineffective assistance to vacate the conviction. I certainly agree that sometimes they will fall on their sword and admit that what they did was ineffective, but I don't think that it'd be very rare for them to intentionally commit malpractice. The other point I'll just make is that there are lots of states that have already, as the court said here, there are at least three state Supreme Courts that have already upheld this constitutional right. There was a split between the lower courts, and the majority of them had already ruled, in favor of Mr. McCoy's position here. Some of those decisions are decades old, and we haven't seen anything like the kind of fraud or misconduct that you're suggesting. So in practical terms, I really don't see that as a likely problem.
While waiting for more questions, a brief announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Friday, the 18th, and will be on the Ninth Circuit case Animal Legal Defense Fund versus Wasden. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleform conference calls on the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleform calls that you may have missed. Not seeing any more questions lined up. Jay, did you have any closing thoughts and remarks on the case?
Sure. One additional piece that I'll add, just kind of why this case, was so important specifically to the Cato Institute, to make this just a little bit broader. One of our main concerns here with the criminal justice group here is the vanishing role that the jury trial plays in our criminal justice system. This is sort of the jury trial really is the cornerstone of criminal justice in the Constitution. It's mentioned several times in Article 3 and in the Bill of Rights, and this really was the understanding of how you did criminal justice at the founding and throughout most of our history. And yet today, over 95% of cases are resolved through plea bargaining rather than through jury trials, which I think has major implications for the legitimacy, transparency, and accountability of our criminal justice system. That's obviously a very large and complicated problem, but I think it really was implicated by this case because, trials entail a lot of risk. for both sides. But, you know, the least we can do is guarantee defendants that they're going to have an attorney zealously committed to defending their innocence. One of the concerns, points that we raised is, you know, if the state's position had been adopted here, we would basically be discouraging jury trials even more than we already do. So I think that this, you know, I think this is an important decision for the principle of defendant autonomy, but I think in a larger sense, it's a small but important step toward restoring the centrality of the jury trial to our criminal justice system, which is a, you know, large and complex goal, but I think, you know, this is a step in the right direction.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.